a few weeks back, Jeannie and I had the privilege of having five of our eight grandchildren with us for a little few days. And one of the things our grandchildren like to do when they're at our house is that they love to play games. And we try to play all kinds of games with them. In fact, one of our grandsons even calls us the game Papa and Graham. We just do it. Well, during the week that they were here, our oldest grandson, Micah, he and Uncle Asher or myself, we'd get in some heated contest of checkers and playing checkers. On one occasion, I was playing checkers with him, and I think he'd beat me the first game, and we were playing the second one, and I thought I was going to beat again, and I only had one lonely king left, and I thought I was going to have to jump him, and then I was trapped, and it was over, and then all of a sudden, it opened up for me that I saw that I could take my lonely king and jump backwards, and then make another jump, and then make another jump, and I got back up on top, and I won. Well, needless to say, he wanted to rematch immediately right away. No doubt some of you maybe grew up in homes where there was a fierce competition to win. In fact, our daughter, there was one game that we used to play when the kids were at home, and that she just refused. She got to the point she refused to play it because she didn't want to lose. And even if she was second, that was losing to her. So, and I know she got that all from her mother's side of the family, of course. So, but there's one game I really never learned how to play, and that was the game of chess. I guess I just don't have the patience for it. I guess it takes quite a little bit of time to do it, and things don't always move very, very quickly. But I did have a friend in high school named Don Walker who just loved to play chess. And the only thing I really remember about all that is that whenever anybody played Don chess, it was soon became a game of chase for him because he had all of his pieces and attacked, and then finally he would say, checkmate, and I can still hear his laughter, and I can still see his face gleaming with delight. But now, aren't those games kind of like life? You know, when you stop and think about it, you think you kind of have everything figured out. You know, the next 2-3 moves, knowing where you are, and it seems that you're going to win, and you think you're going to make it, but then wham, out of somewhere comes that double jump out of nowhere. You've got your strategy all figured out. You think things are moving in the right direction, and life says, checkmate, and you're shocked, just as in the game of chess. And you're what? Where? How? How did that happen? And one of the things, and probably the only thing I remember, though, about chess, is you have to keep your eye on the queen. The queen is to be protected and guarded more than any other piece, perhaps maybe than the king. Am I right? Is that right, those of you who play chess? Isn't that what you want to do? You know, the queen, you got to keep your eye on your opponent's queen. Where is she? What is she doing? What is he doing with her now? Now, you know, that kind of pretty much summarizes in a sentence what we find in our study of the book of Esther today. The downfall of the Persian prime minister Haman was, in a sentence, was he failed to keep his eye on the queen. And she is about to become or to be his most fierce and dreaded opponent. Now, when we left off last week in our study of the book of Esther, you may remember that Esther risked that's a hard one for me to say, risked her life to go and stand out in front of the king's quarters where he might see her. And of course, he sees her there, and he thinks that maybe she wants some inconsequential thing, like maybe a new outfit of clothing or maybe a piece of property, or maybe she wants to add on a new addition to the palace. And so she is invited to approach the king. He holds out the gold. gold scepter, which in effect is really saying, come on in and tell me what is on your mind. Now that was totally out of what everybody expected, because everybody was just holding their breath, bated breath, waiting for what the king might do. And you remember the king then said to Esther, what is it that you want? What is your request? I'll give you even up to a half of the kingdom. And I told you last week that little phrase, the half of the kingdom, is an idiom of speech. It's an idiom to mean I'll do anything I possibly can to satisfy your request. And with that then, Queen Esther invited King Ahasuerus and Haman, his prime minister, to dinner there that evening and ordered to deliver to them her request in private. But then to our surprise, and I believe probably hers as well, she froze, and she let her fear get the best of her, and she choked, and she said, well, we'll come back tomorrow night, and I'll tell you what is my petition. But now, none of this took God by surprise. And in fact, during this whole intervening time between the first banquet on the first night and the one on the second night, God was at work. God was working. And you may remember last week, those of you who were here last week, you'll remember that we talked about how God is at work even when, those 3 points, God is at work even when circumstances are uncontrollable, when they're outside of your control, when you can't make things right. God is at work even when life is unpredictable. And by the way, you can write those down in your notes. There's some blanks there in your notes. You can do that. But life is God is at work even when life is unpredictable. And you remember, I told you last week that stability doesn't come from life. If you're waiting for life to give you smooth, placid waters on which to sail out on the rest of your life, if you think you're going to have it all figured out and you're going to know how it's all going to be mapped out from here on out to the end, you're never going to get there. It's not going to be that way, because stability in life doesn't come from life, but stability in life comes from trusting in and knowing that God is at work even when life is unpredictable. And then number 3, we said that God is at work even when sin seems unstoppable. It appeared there that all the Jewish people were going to be annihilated. Haman had got his wishes. He'd written the edict that every last single Jew living in the Persian Empire, all the way from Ethiopia in Africa over to India, they were all going to be destroyed, annihilated. 15 million of them. But then God moved in, and God worked, and God was at work there. Now, in this case, God gave Ahasuerus, the king, a divinely inspired insomnia. He couldn't sleep. And so he calls for the Persian congressional record to be brought up from the palace library, and surely, thinking that that'll surely knock you out, some dry minutes from a dry board meeting. Surely that will do it. And he asked the servant just to read what seemed to be randomly from somewhere in the record. And he just happens to read from an account of an event that had happened 5 years before this, when Mordecai had tipped off the king concerning a plot for his life. And when the king then, when he had read the record or had the record read to him, he discovered that nobody had ever really honored Mordecai for what he had done in saving his life. Now across town, at the very same time as he was reading and hearing all this, Haman, you recall, that wicked, demonically inspired Hitler of that day, he was plotting to have Mordecai put to death. In fact, he was constructing his 75-foot gallows that he was going to hang Mordecai or impale Mordecai upon. He, however, didn't know what was going on over in the king's quarter. He was just at home thinking, this is going to be the greatest day of my life. We're going to get rid of Mordecai, and then I'm going to go to the queen and eat again tonight. And he was all excited. He couldn't sleep. He got up early there that morning, and he went to the king's palace, because now he has to get the permission of the king to go ahead and put Mordecai to death. And yet, however, when he gets there and before he can find out what's going on or tell the king what he wants to do, the king asks him a question: "What should I do to honor the man I want to honor?" And you remember Haman? He thought, "There's nobody better in the kingdom than me. Surely, if he wants to honor somebody, he's going to honor me. I'm the greatest man in the kingdom, and so I get to tell the king what I want as my own present. I get to ascribe to him." And so he tells him what all to do. And to his chagrin, he finds out it wasn't him that he wanted to honor, but it was Mordecai. And he had to lead Mordecai through the city streets, riding upon the king's horse, dressed in the king's apparel. And he had to say, "Glory, the glory of the one whom the king delights to honor." Now, Haman had it all mapped out. He had it all figured out. He thought, "I make this move, and then I'll make this one, and I'll make this one." But the game of life for Haman became a game of chase. He had failed to keep his eye on the queen. And because he failed to keep his eye on the queen, as we're going to discover in our study today, he's going to lose his own life. Now we're in Esther chapter 7. We're doing a verse-by-verse study through the book of Esther. For those of you who are visiting with us this morning, we've been moving along. This is the sixth study in our study. And you know, I really want to thank those of you who've expressed to me your gratitude for the things that you've learned and the application of the text. You know, as I was thinking about that this week, I was thinking about what Paul wrote in Romans chapter 15 when he said that whatever things were written aforehand were written for our learning, talking about the Old Testament scriptures. The book of Esther was written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort might have hope, that we might have a certain confidence concerning the future. You know, the best way I know how to prepare you for the days ahead, for whatever's coming up in the future, the best way I know how to prepare you as people is to teach you the Word of God and to show you how it applies to your life. Even such a book as the book of Esther will help you be able to face the future. All right, now let's look here at Esther chapter 1, or 7, excuse me, and verse 1. And we read there now, "So the king and Haman went to dine." Literally, they went to party with Queen Esther. And this is the second night now, the second day. And at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, "What is your petition? For out with it, Esther. What is it that you want? You know, you don't have to be afraid. I'll tell you. I'll try the best I can." And he said, "I'll grant to you what you request. Up to half of the kingdom, it shall be done." In other words, what do you want, Esther? And I promise to grant you your request, no matter what the price tag is. And now yesterday, you remember that Esther had froze. And the question is she going to do that again today? Is she going to get fearful and again afraid to give her a request? Well, we find in verse 3 that she answers the king and she says, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I." And then he borrows from a direct quotation from chapter 3, verse 13, from the edict that Haman had written. She borrows and she says, and "my people and I to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated." Now, as I said back there when we were studying chapter 3, I said, that's a little bit of an overkill, isn't it? You know, to be destroyed is to be killed, right? If somebody's destroyed, they're killed, right? And to be killed is to be annihilated, right? How many times do you have to say the same thing? But he wanted to make sure there were no loopholes. Now Esther, here at this point, she says what it is that she wants. It's not trinkets she wants. It's not toys. It's not stuff. She's asking the king to spare her life. "Save my life and the life of my people, for we are being threatened." And in fact, if you miss it, You can't help but pick up in this very courageous and diplomatic and wise speech. There's an obvious change that has taken place here. More than 5 years before this, she decided she was going to hide her identity. She wasn't going to let anybody know who she really was. Her motto has been, I'm a Jew, but nobody's going to know it. I'm going to live like a secular Jew in a foreign land. I'm going to live as the people of God as if there is no God. That was her decision. She has hid it for 5 years. But at this point, you know, I was thinking about this. You know, at this point, you know what she could have done? She could have gone on with the masquerade, couldn't she? She could have come in here to the king that day and said, you know, king, I heard about the edict that you signed about the Jews being killed. Hey, I think the Jews are really nice people. In fact, I've got some of them serving as my attendants. And so why don't you rethink this thing? But she doesn't do that. She comes out with it. She says, me and my people, we're being threatened. In fact, if you would, why don't you circle that personal pronoun, my, there? She says it twice in the text. Me and my people and I. Now, you need to understand, all of this is happening very, very quickly here. It's all in fast forward. Now, I'm pushing the pause button along the way, stopping here and there, but things are happening very rapidly here. In fact, they're happening so fast, King Ahasuerus is having difficulty catching on. He doesn't really know what is this? What's this all about? What's happening here? Esther, your life is threatened. The life of your people? What are you talking about? But let me tell you, Haman knew exactly what was happening here. Haman caught on because, listen, Haman was the guy who wrote the edict. He knew what he wrote. And when Esther said, my people are being destroyed and killed and annihilated, he got it. And he knew it. And he was scared. Now, Esther goes on. She creates even more suspense and tension. You notice in the middle of verse 4 that she said, now had we been sold into slavery, sold as a male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's losses. In other words, she said, oh, king, you know what? If it was just the fact that we were being sold into slavery, I wouldn't have bothered you with this. You know, I know that would be a great loss to you, but I wouldn't have told you. But we're not just being sold as slaves. We are going to be slain. And this is altogether stunning news. Stunning news to both the king and Haman. Neither one of them had any idea that Esther was a Jewess. That would have been her little secret. But now for the first time, the king is finding out that his wife is Jewish and is in danger, and he doesn't really know why. Now, I'm convinced in my study of the book of Esther that Haman really did not know, or I mean, Ahasuerus, the king, didn't know who the people were that Haman wanted dead. I think in Ahasuerus' own callousness to life, he just said, you know what? If there are some people out there who are being a pain in the neck to you, Haman, go ahead and kill him. And he never bothered to read the fine print. He gave, in fact, if you go back to chapter 3, you find out that it was Haman who wrote the edict, and it was Haman who took the king's signet ring and marked the edict. So I don't think Ahasuerus has any idea here. And he's learning for the first time now Esther's a Jewess and that it was the Jews that Haman wanted dead. Now, in fact, now Esther begins to share, and listen, she doesn't give all the details. You got to get over to chapter 8 before you find out she really tells more Ahasuerus what's really going on here. She doesn't even reveal yet until chapter 8 that her and Mordecai are cousins. She doesn't do that. But Esther wisely refrains from giving too many details. She knows her husband. Ladies, do you know your husband? When you need something, you don't give him too many details, right? What happens when you give him too much details? What happens to your husband? He gets lost in all the details, right? And he sometimes misses what you're really saying. So if you want him to get it, be specific. Point blank. And so Esther is being point blank here. She says, my life and the life of my people are in danger. And she grabs his attention now. Now, Haman is terrified here at this point as he discovers to his shock that Esther is Jewish. That he knows exactly what Esther is saying here. For he's the guy, as I said, who wrote the edict. He had put it exactly that way. And he had been licking his chops now for days to get rid of these people, to finally settle the family feud between his people, the Amalekites, and the Jews. Yet to his horror now he discovers that all the people in the kingdom who is a Jew, it's Queen Esther. Apparently, he had failed to take note of the queen. He had not kept his eye on the queen. All because of the providence of God. Now, Haman is sick to his stomach at this point. His heart is racing. He's wondering what's next. The king is enraged. Somebody's after his wife. Frankly, he thinks somebody's trying to not only get my wife, but he's really trying to get the authority of the kingdom. And so we read in verse 5, that King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, who is he and where is he who would dare to presume in his heart to do such a thing? Now, how would you like to have been Haman there that day? There's only three of you there. Just the king and the queen and you, and Haman. And the king is enraged. Who is he? Where is he? Who would do such a thing? And you're sitting there squirming. You know, have you ever been in a situation like that? Maybe you remember back in your school days, you got in trouble at school and your brother found out about it, saw it happen. And you're sitting at dinner that night and there's this silence there that night. Nobody's saying things. And then all of a sudden, your brother pierces the silence with saying, hey, do you know what happened at school today? And you know you're sunk. That's the way Haman felt. He must have felt something like that. Verse 6, and Esther said, the adversary and the enemy is this wicked Haman. She's out with it. She doesn't just blurt out his name, it's Haman. But she says, he's the adversary, the enemy, and this wicked Haman. Now remember, Haman's the prime minister. He's the guy right up there next to the king. He has the full confidence of the king. You know, this would be like Melania, the wife of President Trump, saying, Vice President Pence is out to kill me. Or the Secretary of State is the guy who's plotting to kill all my people and me. Now Haman, he knows he's doomed. He's terrified, rightly so. Verse 7 says that the king rose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and he went to the palace garden. The text indicates, again, this is all happening in very rapid succession. The king quickly gets up. He rushes out. And why does he do that? Why doesn't he just shout out like the queen and Alice in the Wonderland, off with his head? But he doesn't do that. He rather gets up and he goes out into the garden. And can't you see him there pacing back and forth and up and down? He's pondering this. How could he punish Haman for an edict? He gave him permission to stamp with his own royal seal. How can he deal with Haman without admitting his own role? How can he rescind the edict, which is now a law of the Medes and Persians? And how can he protect his wife, Esther? Why? Why did I read the fine print? Now what am I going to do? What do you do when you know you've been wrong? What do you do when you know you've been wrong? All of a sudden you're faced with the fact that the principle of life that you've been living by, an attitude that you've held, you find out now it's wrong and you know it's wrong and you shouldn't have been doing it. What do you do when you've been wrong? Do you evade it? Do you deny it? Do you excuse it? Do you ignore it? Do you get angry at those who make you aware of it? Do you remember the rich young ruler who came to Jesus? And you remember in Jesus, in just a few sentences, revealed to the rich young ruler what his problem was, and he showed him that his love for money and possessions was the thing that owned his life. And Jesus told him to go and sell what he had and give it to the poor. And you remember the young man went away sorrowful because he wasn't willing to do that. And it grieved the heart of Jesus. But my friend, you know what? He wasn't willing to admit his fault. There's only one thing we ought to do when we're at fault. You know what that is? We ought not to deny it or defend it, but we ought to acknowledge our wrong for what it is. To confess it. Oh, not for forgiveness. That's taken care of at the cross. But you know why a believer confesses his sin today? We confess our sin for freedom. We confess our sin for empowerment. We come into agreement with God about it. That's what you need to do if you are made aware of the wrong in your life. You come to Him and you confess it and you acknowledge it so you can be freed from it. Now, I just happen to know that some of you are struggling with this. You don't want to face your sin. You don't want to face your disobedience. You don't want to come out with it. Because, you know, if you had to come out with it, it's going to mean you're going to have to make some drastic changes in your life. You can't continue in the way you've done it. That's how King Ahasuerus was. He now had to face his own wrong. He had to face what he had done. He had to face the fact that he had not overseen Haman in the way that he should have. That he was at fault. Look there at verse 7. So the king arose in his wrath from drinking wine, and he went out into the palace garden, but Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther. He saw that evil was determined against him by the king. Haman makes a split-second decision here. What am I going to do? If I follow the king out of the garden, he's angry with me. I'm sure he's not. That's not going to be a pretty scene. If I run, well, that's an option. But if I ran, that would be to admit my own guilt. And the king would sure to send his soldiers after me and quickly, and they would kill me. He's being checkmated by the providence of God and who has moved the queen into position, who has exposed his treachery, a queen whom Haman should have never taken his eyes off of. And so Haman makes the only decision that he can think to do, and that was to beg for his life from Queen Esther. Well, what irony is that? He's begging for his life from Queen Esther, who is also whom he has condemned by his own hatred and resentment. So you know what you have in chapter 7 of Esther? You have both Esther and Haman begging for their lives. And so it appears that their lives are hanging on a decision of what the king will do. Now the text tells us here that in his terror and in his implied anger, Haman now in verse 8 has fallen on the couch of Esther, who is reclined for dinner. You know, according to the Persian law, that no man, except for the eunuchs, no man could be within 7 paces of the queen or any one of the members of the king's harem. Persian kings were noted even for killing men who rode their horses too close to the harem just to get a peek. You didn't do it. And by the way, if you ever touched one of the women who belonged to the king, you were immediately condemned to death. Now, because of that, what's going on here? I think when Ahasuerus comes back in from the garden, I think what he finds is Haman bent over the couch of Esther. Perhaps maybe even taking her by the shoulders. And I only imagine, this is my imagination here, I just imagine that he's probably saying, "You, who are you? I'm the prime minister of Persia. And you're just a Jew. And who are you to do this to me?" And he's grabbing her by the shoulders, pleading, telling her that she had no right to do what she had done. And listen, while he's doing that, and I say that because look at verse 8. While he's doing that, the king returns from the palace garden to the place of the banquet of wine. And at this point now, he sees Haman, that he's fallen across the couch where Esther was. And the king then said, "Will you also assault the queen while I'm in my house? Will you also assault the queen? Are you going to take her life right here in my presence?" And as the words left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. And you know why they covered his face? Because he was a man who was not fit to look upon another human being. Nobody else should ever look this man again in the eyes. Never, ever again. Now, whether the king is giving his lengthy sentence there, and or whether they're just going to wait for the trial, I don't know. But that's what the king, what they do there. Now, what's the king going to do? Now, at this point, he is not yet ready to get rid of Haman. Now, Herodias, who was the historian of that time, he writes and says that in order to get rid of the king, that or get rid of someone like a prime minister, there had to be two accusations, serious accusations, to give the death sentence. Two. Now, the king perhaps had two. Number one was Haman's plot to kill the Jews. That could be. It's rather light because, after all, he'd given the command to do that. But he could turn it and say, well, he was after to kill the queen, maybe. Haman's approach to Esther, certainly that was one of the accusations. He'd gotten closer than seven paces. He had fallen over the couch, at least. He was bending over her, perhaps touching her. That should condemn him. But listen, the final nail in Haman's coffin came not from Esther. It didn't come from King Ahasuerus, what he saw. But there was an unsuspecting pawn, a eunuch in the palace who speaks up. And in verse 8, 9, we read about that now. Now Harbona, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, "Look, the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, 75 feet high, which Haman," and note this, "made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf." Now, where did this guy, Harbona, come from? This is perfect. Listen, here he is, one out of hundreds of eunuchs that served in the king's palace. Just happens to be there. And just happens to say, "Oh, king." By the way, have you looked out the window lately? Well, take a look. You see that gallows, that impaling pole 75 feet over there? That's in Haman's front yard. And he made it to kill your freshly appointed beneficiary, Mordecai, on it. That seals the deal. Because Haman now is accused of disloyalty and is wanting Mordecai dead. In fact, in the Greek translation of this whole passage here, they put there that it was for he was executed in disgrace for treason. And so you talk about a double jump. Checkmated at the same time, for the king then said, "Hang him on it." And so they hanged Haman on the gallows that had been prepared for Mordecai. And the king's wrath subsided. Now, you read the story and you say, wow, what a story of irony. That somehow that Haman should be impaled on the pole that he had constructed for Mordecai. Wow, what irony. But you know what? We ought to read the story and see. That's not what God wants to see. He wants to say, wow, isn't it an amazing drama of the divine sovereignty and providence of God? God is at work. God is moving. He's doing things. God is the ultimate strategist. The game belongs to him. And even when he's silent, he is present, remember? And even when he seems removed, he remains sovereign. And even when he seems behind schedule or off the clock or late, his purposes are fulfilled right on time. Now, I know some of our Columbia missions team last week were questioning this, as well as we all would if we were in their shoes. Concerning your delays and your setbacks and your getting home, and it was Satan was in doing all of this, and Satan got a lot of credit. Certainly, indeed, I don't deny that he didn't send his thorns in the flesh to try to buffet you. And yet God has his purposes. God has his purposes in our delays and our setbacks and our struggles of life. And as I think about that, I think about our story this morning, I thought about four observations. There are four basic observations for God's providential ways here. There's a myriad of works here. Now this isn't original. These aren't original with me. I stole them, okay? I stole them from reading I did on Esther chapter 7 this week. And so if you hear somebody else say them, it was probably theirs. I stole it from them, all right? I'll tell you right up front. But there are some things I see, and I try to tweak it a little bit my own, but one of the things I see is that God often uses reversals in our lives to move us forward and to make us deeper. He often uses reversals in our lives to move us forward, to make us deeper. Now think about it. Things were going quite smoothly for Esther and Mordecai. You know, Esther had won the crown. How amazing is that? Mordecai had been elevated to be the CFO of the administrative staff of the king, the chief financial officer. They had been successful in hiding their identity for 5 years. And then wham, out of nowhere, all because of one little egomaniac man who didn't like it because Mordecai, one little Jew, wouldn't grovel at his feet. And everything was turned upside down. And yet, look beyond that moment. For if that edict had never been signed, if this reversal had never taken place in their lives, Esther would have maybe lived out a fairly peaceful, sequestered life in the palace, still hanging on to her secret. And so would have Mordecai. Living as secular Jews in a foreign land. The people of God living as if there is no God. In fact, we have every reason to believe that they would have lived in their hypocrisy and their pretense until they died, and they would have never identified themselves with the people of God. But it was the reversal. It was the setbacks. It was the danger of impending death. It was the hopelessness of the edict that brought them to their knees and caused them to fast, implied to pray in accordance with the words of Joel, which he'd written just a few years before, to return to the Lord with a sacred assembly and a fast with your whole heart. And it caused them to go to their knees and then to get up from on their feet and to stand as the people of God. They had the courage to be different, to trust God. They had the courage to live who they indeed were. Now, dear people, please hear me. Those reversals and accidents, that setback in your life, may very well be God's way of pushing you to make you stand up and live who you are. To live as a child of God. To live as a saint. To live as one who's been set aside belonging to the Lord. That may be why those delays, that loss of promotion, that missed flight connection, that disappointment of a failed relationship, the loss of the family farm, or the tragic accident, may be all God's ways of seeking to move you forward and make you deeper. Secondly, God often uses unlikely things to carry out his thoughts. I love the way that God inserted his plan here. You use an insignificant pawn, Harbona. The last man to nail the last nail to the coffin for Haman. That final piece of information, hey king, look out the window. You see the gallows. You see the impaling pole? He constructed it for Mordecai. Just came from one of the king's eunuchs. Somebody whom people didn't pay a lot of attention to. And yet, at the right moment, God's providence moves him forward. And this little pawn effectively says to the mighty prime minister, checkmate, game's over. Now, as I told you, I've not really played chess. But I'm sure, if I did, I wouldn't want to get beat by a pawn. I would want the king or the queen, or at least a bishop. But a pawn? That's exactly what happens. An unlikely person to bring about God's purposes. And you know why? You know why he used a pawn? So at the end of the day, it wasn't Esther who said, look at what I did. At the end of the day, it wasn't Mordecai and Esther being together that caused the fall of Haman. It was all to the glory of God. God did it all. God accomplished it. And we're amazed at how wise our God is as he works. Thirdly, God often puts us through the greatest difficulty before providing deliverance. The truth is, if God wanted to simply deliver us, he could do that very quickly and painlessly. But the truth is, God isn't after our deliverance. He's after our development. He's not after our deliverance. He's after our development. Our Lord only wanted was to make us comfortable. He wouldn't allow roadblocks and reversals and setbacks and trials and disappointments and delays and hopeless conditions and situations. No, but his goal in working all things together for good to those who love him and who are called according to his purposes, according to Romans 8, 28 and 29, isn't just to make us comfortable. It isn't just to make us happy. You know, some people say, you know, God wants me to be happy. And like, no. That's not his primary goal for your life, to make you happy. You know what God's primary goal for your life is? You as a believing one in Jesus Christ, one who identifies himself with the people of God, you know what his goal for your life is? Is that you might be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren, that there may be many, 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 many more just like him. You might be like Jesus. And dear people, if I've said it once, I've said it 1,000 times. You're never more like Jesus than you are when you're depending on him. Christ's likeness is dependency. Jesus 4 or 5 times said in the Gospel of John, I do nothing of my own self, but only what the Father tells me. It's not my will, but thine be what? Done. That's why he isn't interested in just delivering us from our challenges. But he wants to develop us through our challenges. And so God often not only puts us through great difficulty before providing deliverance, he not only uses unlikely things and people to carry out his thoughts, does he not only use reversals to move us forward and grow us deeper, but then one more, God often offers a special partnership with those who submit his providence. This is that whole co-laboring aspect I spoke about a couple of weeks ago, and that we get to be co-laborers with God. We get to work with him and through him, and those of us who are know him as our Savior, we and the Savior are one, and we work together and as a co-laborer. Certainly there's a mystery to me. But this is what the Apostle Paul wanted to maximize in his own life. And he talks about fruit according to his labor, saying to the Corinthian church, he who plants and he who waters are one. We're just one. We're in the same body together. But each one will receive his own reward according to his own labor. And so it's not that we have some more powerful and greater and more important doing greater ministries. The point is, we serve in whatever way and wherever we are placed on the chessboard of our world by the providence of God. Whether you are a king or a queen or a bishop or a pawn, that's really not necessary for you at all to get caught up with. You just do what the king tells you to do, or the queen, Jesus, tells you to do. purpose is to honor and glorify him. It was Paul's encouragement to the Philippian church for their financial support that is a staggering concept to me. He wrote to thank them in Philippians chapter 4, and he said, he did this. He said that the fruit of my labor will abound to your account. And so here are the Philippians. They're over here, and Paul is out on his missionary journey, and they send some money, and they send some support to Paul to help him. And Paul says, listen, the fruit of my labor is abounding to your account. Do you understand what that's saying? Listen, for those of you who went to Columbia last week, you had a marvelous time and you saw many things happen. But you know what? The fruit of your labor is abounding to the account of those of us who stayed home and prayed for you, who gave for you. It's not just yours only. We share in this together. And it's share and share alike, and we get to be a participant in it. And listen, when we submit ourselves to the partnership of God, we get to share with each other. How would you like to have have the dividend of Paul's work on your account? Wouldn't that be wonderful? Well, that's exactly what he's saying. That's what's happened. Ravi Zacharias, and some of you have listened to him on the radio. But in one of his books, Ravi Zacharias talks about traveling to India on an occasion, and he noticed a father and a little boy weaving some of the most beautiful Indian wedding saris he'd ever seen. In fact, he writes it. Let me read it to you as we close. The sari is, of course, the garment worn by Indian women. It's usually 6 yards of material long. Wedding saris are a work of art. They are rich in gold and silver threads, resplendent with an array of colors. The place I was visiting was known for making the best wedding saris in the world. I expected to see some elaborate system of machines and designs that would boggle the mind. Not so. Each sari was being made individually by this father and son team. The father sat above on a platform 2 or 3 feet higher than his son, surrounded by several spools of thread, some dark and some shining. The son did just one thing. At a nod from his father, he would move the shuttle from one side to the other side and back again. The father would gather some threads in his fingers and nod once more, and the boy would move the shuttle again. This would be repeated for days, for hundreds of hours, until you would begin to see a magnificent pattern emerging. The son had the easier task just to move at his father's nod. All along, the father had the design in his mind, and he brought the threads together. Ravi then wrote, "The more I reflected on my own life and study the lives of other believers, I'm fascinated to see the design of God has for each of us. It is his design. It is ours to respond to the nod in obedience." Just a pawn. An insignificant anybody, Harbona, who just spoke up at the urging of God. Who spoke up at the nod of the Father, and that settled Haman's fate, and that began to bring about the deliverance of God's people. Listen, friend, just an act of obedience at the nod of the Father is all he asks of you. He doesn't ask you to figure out where you ought to be on the chessboard. That's not your job to figure out. It's not your job to figure out whether I'm a king or a queen or a bishop or a pawn. But all he asks is for me just to be willing to do what he tells me to do at his nod. When he nods, we act. Father, thank you for this morning. Thank you for the truths we've seen in the lives of Esther and Mordecai, of Harbona. A man that we know nothing about, but a man who apparently at your urging spoke up at the right moment. May we be those kind of people who are submitted, surrendered to you so that you might work your work in us and that make us more dependent. May we see the reversals and the setbacks and the delays and the heartaches and the problems of life as an opportunity to move us deeper with you, change our lives. May we be willing to admit our own faults, to come into the place, and no matter how hard it is, to confess and acknowledge the sin that so easily sets us up and trips us up. May we be men and women who are willing to make those changes, to trust you, to become those individuals you want us to be in our communities so that we might be a revelation of you. Take us this week as your people here at Union Valley. Keep talking to our heart, Father, and may we be people who obey you at your nod. Amen.